The Offside Rule, We Get It, is brought to you by Continental Tyres.
Hello, it's episode 6 of The Offside Rule, We Get It, brought to you by Continental Tyres, getting you to the game safely. I'm joined by Hayley McQueen.
Yes, we're here for the Offside Rule podcast. We absolutely get it.
We do. And Kate Borsay.
Most of the time, we get it. Yeah, as long as we're feeling switched on and as long as we've properly studied the rule book.
don't be sarcastic on this. There is nothing that's pointing to us going, sarcasm.
Speaking of that, Kate, on that very subject, and I was hosting at SoccerX just this last week, and we're hopefully going to be there next year, aren't we, girls, as well, with our podcast. We'll do one live in one of the auditoriums very large kind of football convention that they're in front of all the very important people. And I was introducing some very important people, talking about video technology, refereeing 2.0. The Dutch FA are very behind this. And it sort of didn't quite go to plan. So it was a presentation that I didn't have to do, but I was with Howard Webb and the CEO of Hawkeye as well, who was explaining how it works in rugby and very successfully in tennis, not so successfully sometimes in cricket. But they were making sure that everybody knew that this technology wasn't going to hold the game down and that it just had to be passed by FIFA. And then once it was passed by FIFA, we may start seeing it in the Premier League. Howard Webb thinks it's a good way off. It was to promote video technology and how quick that you can show things happening.
I think I know what's coming.
During the presentation, none of the videos rolled. They all stalled. It kept jumping. One of the videos wasn't even there. So it was a total disaster as far as presentations go. Yeah, I had a mare.
No, speaking of flashing signs, irony is pointing down right now towards Hayley McQueen. Let's talk about perhaps getting it, not getting it, because topic two is quite key, actually. 4-4-2, we're going to talk a bit formation because it's the death, the knelling sound of the bell, boom, because 4-4-2 might not be any longer. Poor Jermaine Defoe as well. You've got to feel for him, haven't you? Because he loves a strike partner, but everyone's just packing out midfields now. It's all about the attacking midfielder, less and less about having strike partnerships. So we're going to look back over time at successful 4-4-2 formations and just give a little bit of a reason as to why maybe we should not make it redundant altogether. I do understand that the Premier League has changed somewhat, but we can look back and reminisce. Also, I want you to complete this sentence. I may have been a footballer, but I made more money from ... I want you to fill in the gaps because there are so many footballers who've gone on and done some crazy side careers, been very successful at them, and you think that you might know them as footballers, but you'll probably remember them better as something else. That could be the case. You don't have to, by the way. Kate Borsay was getting very itchy earlier because she's like, I don't know whether I can justify the figures here. Don't worry. We'll just take your word for it.
Thanks. I am the daughter of an accountant and sometimes all those numbers get in the way. The need for accuracy and a balance sheet gets in the way.
We'll let you off. It's just a friendly podcast, Kate, okay? We're going to start, though, with a debut to remember. Martial and Matt Jarvis scored on their debuts at the weekend. I'm sure there were more players that did that, but those were the ones that sprung to mind when I was setting these topics. So I want you to look back across all leagues. We can include WSL as well and non-league football, foreign leagues, whatever you like. Give two examples when players have famously scored on their debuts. I'm going to start with Hayley McQueen, like we always do. Over to you.
Well, I've got a couple. One who was a bit of a legend and had a great start, but then a bit of an up and down career as far as injuries are concerned, and wives as well. He's had many. And another who actually lived next door with his wife to us and scored on his debut. And I was there, and Kate, it was against Liverpool. Oh. It was the white feather, the handsome, dashing stallion of Fabrizio Ravanelli, the Italian on his debut for Borough. He was one of a string of big names to come to the Riverside. Brian Robson made sure that the big names were drawn to the industrial, proud town. So there we have it. He came and wasn't one of the most glamorous places in the country, but actually Ravanelli settled for a good few seasons and loved it. And he got off to a wonderful start and bagged a hat-trick against Liverpool on his debut. So talk about that.
More importantly, what was he like as a next-door neighbour?
He was great. Once I came home from sixth form and I'd been locked out of my house, my parents had got out and forgot that I was coming back early from potentially one of my exams, who knows? And he was there with his little son, Luca, and he was just making lunch. And I'd knocked on the door and I said, oh, Fabrizio, because we live three houses very close together in a kind of remote village. I said, my mum sometimes leaves a key here. We've got keys to your house. Can I just have the key? He's like, oh, we don't have the key, but why don't you come in? My wife will make you lunch. So we had lunch. I was 17 years old. So I'd had a few drinks, obviously, in the past under the safe watch of my parents. But okay. He gave me a glass of red wine with a bowl of ice cream. Wine with a little bit of water in it, yeah.
That sounds so dodgy. He gave you ice cream, a glass of wine, sweets by any chance?
And he was then proceeded to go around the dinner table on all fours with his little one on his back, pretending to be a horse. Purely innocent thoughts, purely innocent. His wife was lovely.
Who was the other side of you? I don't mean at this. I mean housewife.
Just a normal couple with three young boys. We actually had Paul Merson moving after that. And Gazza lived next door. Yeah. And then Alan Boxic, who never left the house. He was just like a hermit.
This is where we can highlight how we've had completely different upbringings. We've got Hayley McQueen, who's obviously got footballing neighbours. Kate Borsay in the countryside.
Yeah. Mr and Mrs Peaston and Bonington the cat.
And I'd got Ivor and Gwen and Bob and Carol in Dudley. love them to bits.
Speaking of another foreign player, so that was obviously a debut in the Premier League. Alessandro Pato of AC Milan had a wonderful debut, but it took him a while actually, because when he signed for Milan, FIFA football regulations regarding non-EU minors, he was only 17 when he joined, said that he wasn't able to play in official matches until he was 18. So just after his 18th birthday, what better present could the team give him than to include him in the starting 11? And what better present could he give back than a goal? It was a 2-2 draw against Napoli, but massive rivalry between AC Milan and Napoli. He also set the other goal up as well. And in fact, he's known for doing great things on his debut because, so when he signed for Milan, he was pretty much an unproven 17-year-old, £15 million as well back in 2008, which was an awful lot of money. He certainly lived up to his billing. It was another game where he made his international debut and broke a record in the 2006 Club World Cup. So before he played for AC Milan, and broke Pelé's long-standing record as becoming the youngest ever player to score in a FIFA organised competition at 17 years old, 102 days. So there you go.
Very good. Shall I move on to one of mine? I'll mention I was there. Michael Owen. He scored his debut goal for the Liverpool senior team in 1997. I can't believe how old I'm admitting to be by this story. But it was when Wimbledon were playing at Selhurst Park because their ground was being redone or something, I think. Anyway, Owen came on for Patrick Berg. And I always remember I was with my friend and he was like, oh, it's Michael Owen's debut. And I was really just getting into football in those days, having completely fallen in love with it in 1996. But yeah, 97, I saw quite a bit of Liverpool. Off went Patrick Berger. On came this young. And he looked so young. I mean, he really did look like 14, didn't he?
He still looks really young now, though, doesn't he, to be fair?
Liverpool still lost that game, by the way. That was when I think we must have been challenging United for the title and it all went wrong. It wasn't Owen's fault, but it was a sign of things to come, I hope. Robbie Fowler, just on a Liverpool tip here quickly, he made a great debut too, 1993, League Cup against Fulham. Scored in the first leg. Liverpool won that 3-1. Then in the return, I know this isn't his debut, but this is how to follow up a debut. He scored 5 goals.
What?
Yes, 5 goals for Liverpool in the return fixture. What a hero. I've got some more, but I'll hand over to you, Hoops.
I've gone for braces. Hayley McQueen started it off with a hat trick. I've gone for a couple of braces. Starting with Darren Bent, because he actually scored on his debut more than once, but I'm picking the time when he scored back in 2005-2006. And it was that Premier League season that he joined Charlton Athletic. He scored 2 goals on that debut. That was in a game against Sunderland, by the way. But not only that, he scored in his first 4 games for the club. So he went on to score 4 in the next 4 games. He was the highest scoring Englishman in the Premier League that season with 18 goals. He just was on fire that season. It was the time that everyone was screaming, Darren Bent for England. He just fizzled off, didn't he, afterwards? But really, really good performances from him on his debuts. It doesn't quite rival Adebayor, but I thought we won't go down an Adebayor route. Yeah.
You know who also scores on most of their debuts? Alan Shearer, back in the day. When he signed, he was promoted up to Southampton's first team in 98. He justified that faith. A hat-trick from him on his debut. You can't argue with that, can you? Not only has he scored on his debut for Southampton, he also did the same thing on his debuts for England and Blackburn.
My other brace is Gemma Davison for Chelsea Ladies. She joined Chelsea Ladies, rejoined up with Emma Hayes, who she'd played with earlier on when she was at Arsenal, when Emma Hayes was part of the coaching setup there. Emma Hayes, as the Chelsea Ladies manager, also took her over to the States and then brought her in at Chelsea Ladies this season. She scored a brace against Notts County in her first game. So well done to her. Also had an England call-up that we covered last week in the podcast. And I'm just going to, while we're mentioning Chelsea Ladies, another player who scored on a debut, Fran Kirby. She scored as well.
Ickle Fran. We like Fran, don't we? If we go with recent examples, we've got to look at Aguero. Oh, haven't we really? Sorry, I can't.
Kate's best Martin Tyler.
I can't say his name without going all Martin Tyler. He didn't even get a full game. Mancini had him on the bench against Swansea, I think it was, and thought, you know what, I'll just give him a little half an hour run out. He's new to this Premier League lot. Let's just give him a little run round. He only came on to score twice and then set up the next goal as City scored 4-0 against Swansea on that day. And he said in his post-match, hopefully this is the start of something big. Yeah, I'll say it probably is.
I'm Gary Neville and you're listening to The Offside Rule.
Next up, as promised, it's the formation chat. 4-4-2. The death of 4-4-2, it seems, in the Premier League. Jermaine Defoe has inspired this because I saw many people commenting on the fact that he likes a strike partner. And of course he does. You look back over the years, he had much success with strike partners. So he's become a bit redundant and I feel sorry for him. So what I want us to do is justify why 4-4-2 should not be retired forever. I understand that things have changed. The attacking midfielder is very valuable in a Premier League team especially. But let's talk about success had with 4-4-2 formations. I'm going to start with Hayley again.
Well, there's the famous 4-4-2 of 1999. 4-4-2-1-9-9-9. No. So Manchester United obviously won the treble and they managed to do it with the 4-4-2 formation. I'm sure you two might have that as well as one of your suggestions in this topic. However, quite a few seasons later, Sir Alex Ferguson had actually said the orthodox 4-4-2 that he had employed to win the treble, I think a couple of seasons before he was defeated by Real Madrid in the Champions League, said it just doesn't work anymore. Sir Alex as well actually always says, and he maintains that he's never played 4-4-2, has always used split forwards. So it was never quite the 4-4. He always lined them up as a 4-4-2. Come on, yeah, Sir Alex. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But when Real Madrid defeated emphatically Manchester United on the home soil as well for United, 3-2, and they had their 4-2-3-1 formation just completely outrun and outplayed United, he realised just wasn't going to quite cut it. And the fact that obviously British teams doing so well in Europe and European teams, apart from one Spanish team, which I'm going to mention in a moment, not really bothering with 4-4-2 anymore, just doesn't work, does it? Doesn't cut it anymore.
We think that we've seen the death of it recently, but actually, I think it's been the last decade that it's been fading out. If you go back to the 2006 World Cup, I'm going to give you an example of a side that still managed to get very far and do well by playing it. But most of the teams, if you look, they were playing a 4-2-3-1 or something similar. And it was Germany who stuck with 4-4-2 in the 2006 World Cup. They got really far and they still had success with it. But everybody else really had started to switch by then. That's why I'm mentioning that World Cup in particular before I hand over to Kate, who's itching to get started on this, by the way.
That's my favourite thing ever. Funnily enough, though, at the next World Cup in 2010, of the 32 teams in it, 27 of them were employing that 4-2-3-1, which is the formation that you mentioned that Manchester United had been overrun by. And it's just become well out, hasn't it? It's become well out to basically try and... I think Brendan Rodgers has talked about this because obviously, you know, his famous strike partnership, the SAS, the Suarez and Sturridge thing, you know, he sort of said, no, well, I'm not really a 4-4-2 man. What I like to do is this instead. And, you know, a little bit like Fergie, you think, well, took the front four largely in midfield, four largely in defence. That looked a little bit like a 4-4-2 to me, Brendan. But oh no, he's not really a 4-4-2 man. He likes to employ. Now, you know, fair enough. You've got your diamonds and everything else and all the other fancy formations that like to go on the manager's tactics board. Those magnets magnetised around the board as the manager starts flicking them around and messing around, and the poor players don't know what's going on, do they? But interestingly enough, of course, it's been used to overturn Barcelona, Atletico being the most famous example of that one. But Malaga tried it too. And I think, well, and also Manchester City tried it. But I think that what you've got to do in that situation is not use 4-4-2 to kind of use your two strikers to run up and score on the offensive against a team. You've got to use your 4-4-2 to try and frustrate a team. So I think that where some people go wrong with a 4-4-2 is they try and use it as that attacking formation because of the strength of two up front. But actually, perhaps what you should be doing in this arena nowadays is using your 4-4-2 to frustrate the opponent.
I think you have to use it as a very high pressing offensive tactic. I think if you're going to use 4-4-2, you have to press high, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Roy Keane actually decided that he would take what he'd seen and learned and played in at Manchester United as far as a 4-4-2 is concerned and stick with that whilst he was at Sunderland. Now, in his last ever game when they were defeated, his last ever game by Bolton 4-1, he admitted that the 4-4-2 formation had actually been a real part of the problem. He wanted to stick it out. He wanted to continue with it. Kenwyn Jones and Cisse, that forward pair, lots of power, lots of pace, terrified defences. Well, it didn't really matter in the end because Bolton, who had five midfielders, completely outnumbered them, outplayed them and rendered them unable pretty much to work the ball into dangerous areas. So he said it doesn't matter how strong and, you know, pacey his forward two were. Maybe just weren't quite intelligent enough. But he said that this is the end of 4-4-2. I've tried it with the best possible players that I can have. This is at Sunderland, by the way, and it just didn't work. And they were beaten by Bolton of all teams.
So what do you do in that situation? You rely on the good old traditionalists to show that it can still work. So who do we turn to? We turn to Roy Hodgson and we turn to Fulham. Yes. 2010, got all the way to the Europa League final playing 4-4-2 religiously, all the way through to Europa League final. Surely that's proof, is it not, that it works?
And Atletico Madrid, you mentioned Diego Simeone winning the league, of course, and they were on course for that double. They'd had a really great season in both cup and league competition with David Villa and Diego Costa up front. And it really did work. Their high intensity pressing, the compactness allowed them to really play it in a very successful way.
Follow us on Twitter at Offside Rule Pod and like our page on Facebook. Simply type in the Offside Rule We Get In. There's only one of us.
We're going to move on to topic number three. I may have been a footballer, but I made more money from something else. You look at other successful careers and there's so many. I didn't realise until I started doing more research on this topic of how many footballers have got other pursuits.
Yes.
Successful ones.
But again, I got a bit caught up in the detail here.
Oh, gosh, what's going on?
And I was actually physically looking for someone with more earnings. So to find someone, unless they're old school, to find someone like a current player, not current, but you know what I mean, within the last 15 years.
Have you been on Company's House?
No, but just to find a player who's more lucrative in another career apart from football is quite difficult unless you go back. I mean, I even found, you know, I found a story about an old 76-year-old bloke player. I'm sure he was very good.
Sounds interesting.
Very good back in the day, but he won $5.5 million on the lotto. So even though all he'd done was fill out a lotto thing, he was technically more richer after his playing career than he was during it.
I think the clue to this topic was don't go for recent footballers because they earn an absolute fortune. You just wanted to go back about 15, 20 years or so, and then you're on to a good one. Hayley's going to give us an example of exactly how you should have done this topic, Kate.
Not quite, but within the last 10 years, lots and lots of footballers tend to get into property. It seems to be sort of a good way of doing it because they can afford to just go and buy up streets, do the property up and sell them on. As we know, Robbie Fowler's someone that's done that, but so has Ramon Vega of Tottenham Hotspur, the Swiss former centre-half. In 2006, he founded Matterhorn Capital Rossalp. Sounds just like a little company that he ran himself when he went back to Switzerland. However, he's made millions from this. One of his first ever projects was developing a luxury hotel, and now he develops many luxury hotels. It was in Verbier, the ski resort. Mm. So ski resort to the rich and famous. And he had a members club which boasts wall-to-wall gold leaf decor and Swarovski crystal top cocktails, which cost £4,300 a pop. That is right. So no wonder he's made more money from these hotels and clubs in Switzerland than he did in his football career, when he's charging that for a glass of mojito.
A lot of money in Switzerland, isn't there, Sepp Blatter? A lot of money. I'm going to go... Well, actually, I'm going to mention Robbie Fowler, because we were having a chat about this earlier. He's got a property academy. You can go and learn how to be a property guru from the guru, Robbie Fowler. It's incredible, isn't it? And he does own whole streets, doesn't he? He literally buy whole sort of tenement type streets, really, in Liverpool, but also in several other northern towns as well. Just the thought of sort of popping along. Is it actually Fowler who teaches you? Does he stand at the front of a seminar room and can you understand what he's saying? I mean...
Well, Liam Gilmore, who's the fellow property investor, who I have no idea who he is. He's obviously not an ex-footballer, but he's a great businessman. Well, he is the one that is the keynote speaker. So back in 2013, they went round to a lot of the academies at football clubs to give an introductory workshop. They charged for a three-day session, £997. But in these academies, not just within football academies, within football clubs, but the academies that they set up to try and teach young people how and where to invest their money wisely when they come into money.
Fair enough. I'll give you a quick one, because I did understand the topic and I did go for an ex-footballer. I've read the book. In fact, it was written by a friend of mine. Lee Sandford used to play for Portsmouth and Stoke, Reading, Sheffield, and England's youth team. He was a footballer, retired, and went on to become a trader and now teaches people how to trade on things like the currency markets, the oil markets, etc. Anyway, he's written a book. Well, my friend's written a book with him called From Goals to Gold. And... Oh. Catchy title, I know. And I have to say, I'm not biased, but for anyone listening, go on, you know you are, who's interested in trading, okay, you can make a heap of money doing this. He's got a great book on it. I have to say, he's got a really good book. It teaches you all the ins and outs of trading. And has shown how he's gone on to become incredibly successful.
So you could have inferred the topic like I have. You know, I said it was about making more money. Well, you could have done a play on words here, because former Newcastle United striker Wyn Davis went on to become a nighttime baker, and he said, quote unquote, "You can tell the fans I'm making lots of dough now."
Oh, and his name is Wyn Baker. What was it?
Wyn Davis.
Oh, Wyn Davis. What? Okay.
Anyway, that was just a bit of light relief for us. This one I'm going to have to do very quick, because Kate will say, "Well, tell me off." But Terry Venables, because he's not got more money from this than he does from football. However, he did go on to own a nightclub, apparently a very successful one. Made him quite a bit of dosh, along with being a managing director of QPR, a chairman at Tottenham. All related to football, but different roles than a footballer. I suggest add those all together and you might get more money. Also, as well, he entered into the world of writing. He was a co-creator of an ITV series, Hazel.
Yes, he was. Yeah, I did know that. He also sang, didn't he, as well?
He did a bit of singing as well. We spoke about Robbie Fowler and the fact that he had an absolute fortune in properties. Well, I'll raise you from Robbie Fowler to David Ginola, because you know what Ginola has, which is worth a small, tidy sum?
Hair.
He does have hair.
Insurance. Or a lot of shampoo.
He's a winemaker. Okay. Of course, being French, yeah. And
he can't tell me he earns more money making wine than he does as a footballer. Is this really just a topic about what ex-footballers do after they retire? Because it's like a wolf dressed in sheep's clothing, Lindsay Hooper.
Mm. I know, but I challenge you to look.
One of your all-time favorites. You love this topic. You love this topic, and you've brought it back for the third time under a different guise.
No, it's not the third time. I mean, it's not a disguise, Kate. If I wanted to go down that route, I'd have told you about an ex-Fulham and Wales striker, Gordon Davis. He went on to become a pest control expert. Oh, yeah. If I wanted
you're
to just
a
say,
pest. You're a blooming pest.
You're a pest. What about the Danish guy that went on to become a fisherman, eh?
Yeah, Ray Wilson, 1990. Ray Wilson, 1966 World Cup winner, went on to become an undertaker.
You see? Yeah.
See, I'd do that, wouldn't I? If I was trying to do it, I'd do those. Well, but I gave you different examples.
Well, what the good folks at home don't realise, this is one of your favourite all-time topics. And you've even got a notes section on your mobile phone where you save up any little job that you find over the months that a footballer's done. You think, oh, I must save that one for the next time that I bring back that topic for the fifth time, but I'll just disguise it as something slightly
different. I do love it. Did you know as well, Alan Comfort?
No,
he's now a vicar.
Alan Comfort, yeah. What, comforting people? There has to be a gag in there somewhere.
Exactly. I love it. I've got loads of them in my notes section on my phone. Right. But I went with the lucrative ones. These aren't lucrative. So I'll give her a chance.
Mine is on topic, so absolutely. Mid-90s footballer Jamie Pollock, most known to me, of course, at Middlesbrough, but also actually played for Bolton, Crystal Palace, Birmingham and Manchester City as well. But Osasuna, I didn't know that. So he's well-travelled, cultured, and he actually, after football, is something of a kingpin. In the windows and glazing industry, he runs Poulton Glass, Jamie Pollock, him and his business partner. It's a glass and energy efficient windows. No, he's made millions.
You wouldn't call it Pollock.
Poulton Glass.
You wouldn't call it Pollock Glazing.
Pollock Glazing, no. They employ 100 local people and take deliveries of 20 tonnes of glass a day, into 750 windows a week.
If you took 20 tonnes of glass a day and made 750 windows a week, I would see that as a great mark of success.
But actually, do you know what? He's successfully secured planning permission to build a £750,000 football centre in the area, which is very badly deprived. Obviously, Middlesbrough's a working class town, to help with sporting facilities as well. So really great value for the local community. He's using his own money to do this. Obviously, potentially might then sell the land off to footballers to put properties on it in the future. But right now, he runs the Poulton All-Stars Academy. So that helps kids 7 to 15 prepare for and get into professional football. And then he also helps academies help young players when they've been let go by football clubs to rediscover their confidence and love for football and teach them the values of work and how maybe to enter into an industry which is something completely removed from the world of sports. So he's earned his stripes on the pitch, he's putting it back into football and earning his millions through double glazing.
Good on him.
I think Hayley McQueen wins this topic this week. By the way, I'm going to leave you. I've just been scrolling through my notes. I found another brilliant one.
Oh,
go on.
Did they earn more money?
No. Well, I don't know, because what sum can you put on this? I think this is a bit like MasterCard. It's priceless. Swedish international Thomas Brolin went on to make a record with Dr. Alban, starred in a jacuzzi advert and hit the headlines after his car collided with an elk.
Do you know what, Lindsay? We have done this one before. Many, many years ago.
I love it.
Folks at home, if you scratch around in the early episodes of the podcast, about 3.5 years ago, he gets a mention, Brett.
Does he? Yeah, no, you sure?
He does.
What about the award-winning Bishop's Guest House in York? Who's it run by? Marco Gabbiadini. That's right.
We're going to have to leave it there.
Very accommodating he is too.
Thank you very much, ladies. We'll be back with episode 7 next week. Hope you've enjoyed this one. Go to offsiderulepodcast.com for a full list of new articles that have been uploaded over the last week or so. If you've not got up to speed with those, make sure you take half an hour out of your day tomorrow. That's my little suggestion for you.
My other suggestion was maybe come down and watch Dulwich Hamlet playing football.
We're recording next Tuesday.
We are. We're going to be at Dulwich Hamlet Football Club next week for our sins. No, I think they're brilliant. We might cut this bit out, by the way, so we don't get hordes of
popcorn. I want to see if another 10 come through the gate.
Yeah, one.
Ticket sales soar on the back page of the East Dulwich Recorder.
Bye.
The Offside Rule, We Get It, is brought to you by Continental Tires.